Yolanda McKinney moved from Wyandotte County to Johnson County to start a new life after years of alcohol and substance abuse.
Moving out here, I was like, wow, there's a liquor store in every strip mall.
Yolanda and her husband Carl were surprised by the relaxed attitudes toward drinking they saw in the wealthier neighborhood they had just moved to.
Oh, he's just a good old boy versus he's a no-good old boy having the same issues, the same usage, but a different stigma attached.
Turns out, facts back up what this couple observed. In Johnson County, the percentage of people who binge drink or drink heavily exceeds that in Wyandotte County by about 20%. The county also has a higher incidence of traffic fatalities linked to alcohol. You may have caught that story about alcohol addiction on Morning Edition. Well, I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to zoom in on this issue from our week-long series on health disparities in Wyandotte and Johnson counties. We'll look at alcohol use throughout the metro with a focus on what's going on in Johnson County. I'd like to start by getting some information on the drinking trends in our area from Heather Gotham. She's an associate research professor in the School of Nursing and Health Studies at UMKC. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
What's going on with the rates of alcohol abuse on the national level?
Well, I think it's really important to kind of peel apart some of the terms that we're using. So we've talked about something called binge drinking, which, and all of these terms have different definitions, but binge drinking is generally something like drinking more than 5 drinks for men or 4 drinks for women on any single occasion. So that's binge drinking. Heavy drinking has even more diverse definitions. Sometimes it's just drinking more than 1 or 2 drinks per day regularly, and sometimes it's looked at more as a frequent binge drinking.
So a drink a day regularly is heavy drinking?
More than 1 drink a day for women and more than 2 drinks per day for men. Sometimes that's the definition of heavy drinking. And those two things I think we need to think about as opposed to an alcohol use disorder, a diagnosable use disorder. We used to call that alcohol abuse or dependence, but in the more recent formulations of our diagnostic system, we now use the term alcohol use disorder. And that's more of a pervasive pattern of negative consequences due to alcohol use and isn't particular to how much you drink necessarily.
I see. So, and we are talking then primarily about alcohol use disorder?
Alcohol use disorder. And again, that's a diagnosable disorder. Folks who have an alcohol use disorder have a number of different negative consequences, and most likely those are the folks who would be appropriate for some kind of specialty treatment versus a binge drinking or a heavy drinking, which is a pattern of drinking that drinking alcohol that can result in some negative consequences, but is more amenable just to having the person cut down.
Interesting. Well, what is going on then with the rates of heavy drinking, would you say, on the national level?
On the national level, we're seeing either heavy and binge drinking rates staying about the same or declining even a bit. In particular, in Johnson County, for example, we see rates of binge drinking of about 25% of men and about 14% of women. In Johnson County, whereas in the United States, the rates are 33% for men and 17% for women. So actually, Johnson County as a whole is a bit lower than the country. But what we've seen from some recent data is that there's been a little bit of an uptick in binge and heavy drinking for males, but also particularly for females. And that's a trend we've seen over the past several decades, is that the amount of alcohol that women use is increasing.
So, yeah, I mean, we're looking at data showing that in Johnson County between 2005 and 2012, there was a big increase in Johnson County in heavy drinking. And so I'm interested in that increase and during that time period. What do you think was going on?
I think, again, as we've seen nationally, the rates of alcohol use for women are increasing to be closer to that of men. We're seeing the same things or have seen the same things in the past, for example, for cigarette use or for tobacco use, that women are kind of catching up. And so that might be part of the negative consequence of being in a more affluent world in general, or in particular in Johnson County.
When you say catching up with men, I can't help but think about those old cigarette ads, you know, you've come a long way, baby. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is, do you think that there's something to social change in how women have been a part of that that has also brought this other negative consequence?
I do think that might be part of it, that women are, part of our growing equality with men is also picking up some of those negative health habits.
Does it surprise you that there is this particular increase in heavy drinking among women in Johnson County?
I don't know that. I think that we don't really have enough data to understand kind of what's really behind it.
But you weren't surprised, or you were surprised?
I wasn't necessarily surprised, because, again, over the national scene, we've seen an increase in women's drinking.
Well, we're going to get back to that in just a minute. But in that piece that aired on Morning Edition, we also heard that more affluent communities suffered from higher levels of binge drinking in general. Does your data bear that out?
Yes, there does seem to be an indication of that. I think it's really important for people to understand that the National Institutes of Health have put out low-risk drinking limits, and people find them pretty surprising. But for men age 18 to 65, the low-risk drinking limits are no more than 4 drinks per day and no more than 14 drinks per week. And for women of the same age 18 to 65, the low-risk drinking limits are no more than 3 drinks per day and no more than 7 drinks per week. So those, I think we need to kind of get the word out that those are the low-risk drinking limits. Folks who exceed those limits, either the daily limits or the weekly limits, are putting themselves at risk for different kinds of health consequences. A substance use disorder, a diagnosable alcohol use disorder, is a potential consequence, but even exceeding those levels in a smaller way can result in health consequences, particularly if someone has a chronic other kind of condition like diabetes or heart disease. They can that alcohol intake can be negatively affecting those other health conditions.
I want to hear now a short clip from Alex Smith's reporting on these disparities that we've talked about in Wyandotte and Johnson counties, with Johnson County showing higher rates of alcohol use and heavy drinking than Wyandotte County. Here he has the story of a woman named Kelly.
When Kelly was growing up in Olathe in the 1970s, it was a quiet, clean community full of single-family homes and good schools. And with state laws prohibiting alcohol sales on Sunday, in grocery stores, and by the glass, an outsider might have found life there to be pretty straight-laced.
You just never know what goes on behind closed doors.
Kelly says her father was a highly successful CEO and a high-functioning alcoholic. When she became an adult, she tried to avoid falling into the same trap.
I wasn't going to be like that. I was a full-time mom and worked, a community volunteer.
But a daily drinking habit took its toll. Before she knew it, her alcohol abuse had spiraled out of control.
I did that over a period of time and would wake up the next day and could only go so long physically without putting that into my body.
Sadly, Kelly's story is not an unusual one in Johnson County.
What is it about Kelly's story, do you think, that isn't unusual?
I think it's important to understand that the face of addiction is really anyone's face. And so I think oftentimes we have stereotypes or kind of discriminatory beliefs or stigmatizing beliefs that one particular kind of person is someone who might have an addiction, whereas really anyone can develop a substance use disorder or an addiction.
As we were talking about just very recently, in Johnson County, a lot of the increase in heavy drinking seems to be taking place among women. In fact, in Johnson County, it appears that there's that women are drinking about 50% more than their counterparts in Wyandotte County. And I want to turn to Nikki Green on this. She's a social worker at Shawnee Mission Health. Nikki, that statistical rise in heavy drinking among women in Johnson County is pretty startling for a layperson anyway. I mean, does it correspond with what you've witnessed in your own work?
Yes, it certainly has. we saw a rise just in the last kind of fall semester or period of time at in our intensive outpatient program, seeing just more women coming in for treatment. And there's certainly a variety of factors leading someone down the path of having an alcohol use disorder. I kind of look at it in parts or segments. You know, first, biologically, we kind of have to look at the genetic predispositions that people have. So if there's a family history of someone that has struggled with alcohol or addiction issues, you're at a higher risk, just as if someone had heart disease or cancer in the family. I think for women in particular, hormonal changes are a huge issue. We see a lot of folks come into treatment during kind of the menopause time or kind of just the hormonal shifts and changes in their life. You know, biologically also, sometimes chronic pain issues or underlying health issues that women and men equally might face struggle and try to cope and manage pain or uncomfortable symptoms by using alcohol more. Another big component I see is kind of the psychological kind of factor or arena. You know, women in general struggle with depression 2 times more than men, more than our counterparts. And so we see a lot of folks coming in, women in particular, saying I'm struggling with depression or anxiety, and then recognizing, and alongside, I'm using alcohol as a coping mechanism, and I'm recognizing this is not healthy.
Any understanding, I mean, I know this may not be your focus, but any understanding of why women are experiencing depression in such higher numbers?
Well, women are more often victims of abuse, sexual assault, physical abuse, domestic violence. I mean, that seems to be more under the national lens. More exposure and, you know, prevention methods are used. You know, I think a couple years ago, I remember seeing ads and, you know, during National Football League games where, you know, we're just getting more information and more exposure. You know, what that woman said in the last segment, a lot happens behind closed doors. And I think in Johnson County, there's a lot of people that kind of put on that mask and put on that facade and aren't really sharing genuinely and honestly with someone about what's really going on in their world.
What tends to prompt them to come in and seek treatment to get help and be on your radar?
Again, a variety of factors. Sometimes it is a health condition. Sometimes people are admitted in our hospital and then they step down and get some intensive outpatient services because of health issues that are exacerbated by their alcohol use. Sometimes people come in because of legal issues. Maybe they've gotten in trouble, gotten a DUI or something of the sort. They're coming in prompted by the legal system to seek treatment. But I would say more often than not, it's due to relationships. Family members, loved ones, friends, maybe parents, providing children with ultimatums, you know, get sober or you're not in my house, or spouses, significant others saying this is causing a problem. You're not available emotionally in this relationship. Something needs to be done. You need to seek help. So I'd say more often than not, it's those impairments in relationships that really bring people in.
Yeah. What kind of age range are we talking about? I mean, when you talk about parents saying, you know, you're going to have to leave the house if you don't get help, that makes me feel like we are probably talking about pretty young people.
Sure. You know, I work in a couple different capacities at Shawnee Mission Health. So one role, I work in our emergency department. So I see a wide range of ages, certainly see a handful of teenagers, adolescents struggling with substance use issues or mental health impairments. And, you know, I'm just one piece of that puzzle in helping them, kind of direct a path toward wellness and recovery. In our intensive outpatient program, I just work with adults. So anywhere from ages 18, of course, to I think my last patient recently was 81, seeking treatment for the first time. So there's certainly, as Heather mentioned, you know, not a average face, you know, for addiction. It impacts everyone across all socioeconomic statuses, gender, race, just a lot of diversity.
Have you done this kind of work outside of Johnson County as well?
Primarily been in Johnson County for the past 12, 13 years. Before that, I did just some undergrad work when I was at K-State at the local mental health center, but primarily have been working here in this county.
When you compare notes, like with colleagues or read about national trends and things like that, do you get the sense that the pressures people are dealing with are the same from place to place? I mean, I guess I'm wondering whether there's a problem, like the nature of the problem itself is different in Johnson County, or if it's something else entirely.
You know, I'm not really sure. That's a great question. I was raised in a small town community in Kansas, 800 people. And I can tell you, growing up as a child, it looked differently than raising a child now in Johnson County. There are certainly a lot of expectations, a lot of pressure. There's certainly a lot of opportunity, which I value on the parent and on the child, really. But just the amount of busy activities and things that everyone can get involved with, it's overwhelming at times. And it's hard to live up to certain expectations as a child or as a parent. So I see that as a big factor.
There's a certain kind of drinking that people can be pretty cavalier about. I mean, it's not uncommon after a tough day at work to hear coworkers comparing notes on the drinks that are going to solve all their problems as soon as they get home. Or on weekends, there's a lot of like mock embarrassment over things said and done in bars the night before. But usually that delivery comes with kind of a laugh or a smile. And that's not to say that the occasional wild night is necessarily a problem in and of itself, but is the normalcy of it all a bigger part of our culture than it used to be?
It could be. And I think you're really speaking to that social factor that leads people to drinking or using drugs. It is. It's rationalized a lot. Gosh, I had a hard day at work, or I worked really hard and then I deserve it. People drink to celebrate. I mean, look at, you know, weddings. I had mentioned to Alex, I think, in the previous interview, like...
That's Alex Smith, the reporter who did the story you might have heard on Morning Edition today.
Yes. That even at baby showers I've been to, you know, in the morning, women are drinking alcohol, bunko, you know, parties, card games. There's lots of things that people can normalize and rationalize. Well, this is okay. If I'm drinking around people, this is okay.
And in some communities, there really aren't a lot of opportunities for socializing that don't include alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm remembering a patient not too long ago I work with that literally moved her and her kids out of her neighborhood to another one because their cul-de-sac was known to be the partying cul-de-sac. That's what they did. That's how those relationships were formed. And she didn't see really any way out of getting clean and sober unless she physically moved her family to a new neighborhood. Her kids were put in a new school.
But that's interesting that there would be this other place to go where that's not an issue. I mean, how does one community develop that relationship with alcohol and not another? Are there factors that you can identify there?
I mean, sometimes in Johnson County, I think it's a display of wealth. You know, invitations over to parties and surrounded by sporting events or holidays, and here I want to entertain you, and it can be kind of that idea of, you know, this glamour or, you know, kind of wealth status.
I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR Central Standard is going to take a short break for now, but when we return, we'll talk with a Johnson County woman who's had her own struggle with alcohol, and we'd love to hear from you too. What's the culture around drinking in your part of the metro or within your community? Do you think it's a problem? 816-235-2888. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show on alcohol use throughout the metro and why it looks different in some areas than in others is inspired by a report in the Crossing to Health series airing this week. The story you might have heard on Morning Edition today is about heavy drinking on the rise in Johnson County. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the drinking culture in your part of the metro. Do you think it's a problem? And if you struggled with alcohol, does your community give you the access to recovery tools you need? 816-235-2888. We've been chatting with healthcare professionals Nikki Green and Heather Gotham. Now let's hear from someone who's lived this stuff. She'll be going by first name only. Welcome to the show, Joy.
Hi. Morning.
Where do you live?
I live in Shawnee.
And tell me a little bit about your life right now, like family, work.
Let's see. I am married. I have two children. They both attend school in Shawnee at a private school. I am a substitute teacher. I am the... I'm on the board of my oldest son's lacrosse team. I'm the soccer manager. I'm the baseball manager. Just obviously I'm laughing because of the things that we were just speaking about. Like, these are the pressures of life, right? And I have a pretty normal life. I'm a stay-at-home mom, so I have the opportunity to that allows me to get to do all of these things and be involved with my family.
When and how did your relationship with alcohol begin?
I started drinking just before my 18th birthday. Back then in the 80s, the drinking age was 18. So it was obviously legal. I had started drinking a few months before I turned 18 and then started going to bars legally. So,
Say you started drinking, what did that start look like?
Well, I grew up in way southern Johnson County. I went to Blue Valley when there was one. And, we lived out in the country, if you will, you know, back then that felt like the country to most people. And so it started with, you know, field parties or people just having a party when their parents were out of town, or the Stanley Stampede was a big one that we would drink at. And it just did not seem, it was just what everybody was doing.
Yeah, a lot of people might hear this as kind of a normal but maybe very stressful for parents component of teenage life.
Exactly.
Did it feel different to you then, or really no? It didn't escalate till later, maybe?
No, I can recall thinking to myself that I drank differently than other people or the friends that I was with or my peers. It seemed like I can look back and even then see that I was drinking to excess back then. Like, I was drinking to get drunk. I loved that out of control, crazy feeling. And that started fairly early. I remember being 18 and that started. And, you know, obviously it just continued to progress and get worse. And
did the people around you know that was going on when you were that young, or were you able to hide it?
I was able to hide it a little bit with my parents. Of course, I got grounded a lot when I still lived at home. And as far as my friends, you know, it was just, oh, you got so drunk last night. You were crazy and you drink too much, but kind of all joking. Nothing like, we need to sit down and have a serious conversation. It was never anything like that. But, you know, my drinking got worse a few years later.
What did that look like?
Well, that looked like arrests. That looked like four DUIs. That looked like my parents finally having enough and saying what you were talking about earlier, you need to leave and we're not going to watch you die, and trying to send me to counselors. And
what were the behaviors on your part that were leading to all of these consequences?
By that time, I was not living at home. I had my own apartment, but I was losing apartments. I was losing jobs. I was losing cars. I'm really, really good at getting a job. The problem was keeping the job, because they kind of expect you to show up after you get the job. And I could never do that because alcohol was always the priority. I wanted to work to get money to buy alcohol. It was never, I want to work to get money to provide a life for me. It was just always about drinking.
Do you know what was going on under the surface of all of
it's
that?
It's so weird because as a person in recovery and get to see all kinds of people and what they come in with and their trials, their tribulations, there really wasn't. I'm adopted, so I have no idea what my family history is. I have no idea if alcoholism runs in my family or not. I had, and I speak all over the country about it, I had a perfect childhood. I grew up with a mother and a father who remained married. I had a brother and sister. We went to Catholic schools. I went to church. There was nothing, I wish there was. And then we could say, oh, that's why. But there was never anything underlying. There wasn't a reason that I did that.
What made you decide that you needed help or wanted to change?
Well, after my last DUI, which technically would have been my fourth, I was looking at serious legal trouble. And realized that I needed help. And I'm not so sure that I thought I needed help with not drinking. I needed help to get out of trouble. And so my parents, along with a judge, gave me an ultimatum, and they told me I could go to prison for 3 to 5 years or I could go to treatment. And I pride myself on my intelligence, so I went to treatment. And that's how my journey began.
Did it feel at all like a wake-up call that you had a judge telling you this, or did it still feel like, I just have to do this?
It still absolutely, I love that you said that, because it absolutely felt like I was just taking action to get the heat off. I did that a lot. I just took action to get the heat off, and it wasn't until I was in treatment that something happened. It was a wake-up call in treatment, and I made the decision I don't ever want to go back to that life. It was sad, pathetic, shameful, guilt-ridden, painful, and I never, ever wanted to go back to that life. So I made a decision while I was in treatment.
When do you remember what made that flip switch? Flip. I mean, because it's interesting that you hear that someone has to want to get better, mm-hmm. you know, and that...
I don't know. I'm probably controversial on this topic, because I don't know if you even really need to think you want to get better. I think if you're given an opportunity where there's a choice to be made, and you're given some information, and you know what, I at the risk of offending your listeners, it was God. I said a prayer in treatment. I said, please God, I can't ever, ever, ever do this again. And that was the turning point. It was my burning bush, if you will, that turned it around. And I literally closed the door on that road and went down the other one.
Was your overall community supportive during the treatment process? I mean, obviously your parents had really encouraged you to be there. What about the larger community that you were part of?
Well, you know, I think it's funny because in the 12-step program that I... the principles and steps that I live by, we talk about anonymity, and there's a lot of people that the stigma of alcoholism is so bad that there's a lot of people who do not share that information. And I am one of those weird people that I scream it from the rooftop. So I have from day one told people, shared about it, and I guess the awesome thing is I have never been frowned upon. I have never not got a job because I'm very open when I go into an interview in years past. I have never, ever had a bad experience as a result of admitting that I was an alcoholic.
Do you think that the admission helped your recovery at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because if I would not, I was 26 years old when I got sober. If I had not been open, it would have been really easy to hide that and make excuses and justify behaviors, going to bars or whatever. And I would have ended up falling right back into that.
So you had people who were kind of keeping vigilant
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that I know that you've said you can't point to anything in your personal story that says that's what has to do with it. But what do you think that socioeconomic factors might have had to do with any aspect of your experience? Not necessarily the cause, but just how you experienced this whole journey.
You know, that's a really tough question. And again, like we were talking about earlier, I wish I had a pat answer. And maybe you should have had a different speaker on here I think it's important to show that just a normal Johnson County girl can end up in the same situation as the kid whose parents divorced, or as the kid who was, you know, physically abused, or the girl who was sexually assaulted. Like, we're all in this together. And I do not have a reason. Okay, my dad was too strict. Maybe, I'm grasping at straws at this point to just try to come up with an idea.
Do you view drinking differently than you used to? Not just your own drinking, but in general, like observing it on TV or in restaurants?
I don't know if I observe it differently. I think that over the years, the access, the accessibility, and yes, watching it in TV and movies and such has had an increase. I think that there's so many other factors. You know, I think we have two working parent households now, you know, and I grew up with a stay-at-home mom. And I think when both parents work, if we're talking about the children, you know, they're left with a lot of time on their hands. And then you can get into modern technology. And now they're playing on their iPads all the time. And they're not playing kick the can outside. I mean, there's just so many factors that can go into it. I don't necessarily have a negative opinion on alcohol, because I do believe that there's a time and a place for everything. And I think it's funny, because when we were talking at the beginning about the alcohol use disorder and the binge drinking and all these, I fell into all of those categories, and I was like, wow, just four drinks. I did my weekly drinking in a night, you know, and, I don't know. It's so hard. I wish to God we had here's the answer. Here's the reason. Fix that. And there's just not.
Heather, what do you hear in Joy's story?
I hear an incredible strength of character. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What about you, Nikki? I mean, we've been talking about these trends and these sort of like big picture, like community to community, demographic to demographic, and this is one person's story. Do you hear the big picture demographics bearing out in this story, or when you get into the specifics of a human life, do those things sort of melt away, those distinctions?
I think Joy's story is a lot of people's stories. A lot of people go down this path of abusing alcohol, not because of bad things that have happened to them. And I think that's kind of a misconception mm-hmm. that we have.
Yes.
You know, I'm struggling with an issue or a trauma or a loss. Certainly that's a factor for some people, but for some people it is kind of, I was raised in a pretty healthy, normal, whatever normal is, kind mm-hmm. of household. And right. any of us can go down this path of abuse or addiction, whether it's alcohol or to prescription pain meds or anything.
Joy, are you surprised that Johnson County has been seeing this increase statistically in heavy drinking in recent years?
Not so much. I think that, and again, we're going to talk about all the, you know, mitigating factors that, mm-hmm. that cause this problem. It doesn't surprise me at all. And I think that when you talk about the struggles that kids have today, and if we're, I mean, I don't know if we're focusing on just kids or parents or whatever, but when we're talking about the struggles that kids in general have today and the pressures that parents have today, you know, I grew up playing softball. I did not play four sports at one time. And we've got kids today, you know, mine included, that are playing two, three, four sports at the same time. And that's a lot of craziness, and that's a lot of running around. And then you can get into, let's talk about bullying. I mean, bullying is huge, and for whatever reason has gained whatever over the last many years. And then you get into cyberbullying and all of that, and the pressures that our poor kids have to endure today of, you know, living up to the Joneses and all of that kind of crazy thinking. And then when you have, if you have two parents that are working, they're both trying to provide an income. And then when we can go back and talk about the, you know, women are actually gaining some notoriety and getting better jobs. So now they have the pressures just like the dads did. So they have the pressures to be better, do better, look better, et cetera. And so, of course, they're going to go to happy hour after work and binge drink, because doesn't everybody drink more than four darn drinks?
Nikki, from your perspective, what does that kind of pressure that Joy is describing have to do with these larger trends? We heard about things like people providing in-home care, going through relationship difficulties, but what about factors like the workplace?
You know, I was just kind of thinking a little bit more about the kids and just the trends with the Johnson County kids and all those pressures. And, you know, another piece of my professional life is serving on the Drug and Alcohol Council of Johnson County. So we make recommendations back to the cities on how to disperse those alcohol tax funds. And it's been really difficult this past year in the schools to get measurable outcomes and to really get some evidence on what does this look like for those kids. The Kansas Communities That Care survey has been a survey that 6th grade, 8th grade, 10th grade, and 12th graders complete. Just this past year, there's been a new statute passed that protects student privacy. So parents have had to opt in to allow their students to participate in the survey. So just a little shout out to Johnson County parents out there that have kids in public schools. Please opt in so that we can get more information and more data. I mean, this is hard. You're asking pretty tough questions that it's hard to get factual numbers on right. And to see the big picture, whether it's, you know, kids or adults. Because most often when you go to your primary health provider and they ask how, you know, do you smoke? Do you drink? People underreport. People lie right. all the time.
I was curious about that with the statistics that we do have, because we've talked about, I mean, Carl, who we heard from at the beginning, saying that in Wyandotte County, it was like if you were public drinking or drunkenness, you were a no good old boy, whereas in Johnson County, you're a good old boy. Like different kinds of stigma being attached to drinking in different communities. Does that cause different levels of reporting in different communities?
I'm sure it does.
Right. I think, you know, and I, you know, going back to why is there an increase? Well, there's, I don't know if the increase is such a negative thing. I think that there are more opportunities to get treatment. There, we are talking about alcoholism more openly than we have in years past. So there's definitely more knowledge out there for people to get help. Because if we're just going to report, how are you finding your reports? Are you going door to door and saying, do your kids drink? Do you drink? How much do you drink? Or are we just seeing treatment centers exploding, or, you know, recovery groups exploding, or we're talking about it more? So I think that we have to kind of think about it as being a positive thing on one hand, because we don't know those statistics as far as why they're here.
We'll be right back to this discussion about drinking patterns throughout the metro, why the problem differs from county to county, and we'll shift our attention to recovery and resources. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. We're taking a close look this morning at news that alcohol abuse is on the rise in Johnson County. And I should say, we're speaking maybe more than alcohol abuse about binge drinking and heavy drinking. And that there's a higher incidence of heavy drinking there than in neighboring Wyandotte County. At the same time, recovery seems to work better in Johnson County, at least by the numbers, not necessarily individual to individual. So let's shift our focus to that piece of the puzzle. I'm here with Nikki Green, a social worker, and Heather Gotham, a UMKC research professor with a clinical background. We're also joined by a woman named Joy, a Johnson County resident who's in recovery. And Joy, not only are you a recovering alcoholic, but you also sponsor, what, 20 other women?
Mm-hmm. On any given day, give or take.
That's amazing. I mean, do they come from everywhere in the metro, every walk of life?
Right. I have single women. I have married with children. I have single mothers. I mean, so yes, all demographics.
What are some of the factors that just observationally, not as a professional, but as just someone who is immersed in this day to day, what are some of the factors that you think affect whether recovery sticks?
Well, you know, this is so hard because I'm not a professional. I'm not an expert. I just have my own personal experience and the experience of the people that are around me. I think that for myself and for many people that I associate with within my program, it's about making a decision. It's about trusting God. It's about cleaning house. It's about reaching out to another person and allowing somebody else to help you. And ultimately, it is about surrendering. I mean, that is for you know, that's probably the biggest word is surrendering, and taking some actions and doing some work in order to not pick up that first drink.
Nikki, are there things that you think prevent people from being able to do those things, things bigger than just someone's own, say, commitment, something, yeah, socioeconomic factors, trends, things like that?
Oh, gosh, my first thought, Gina, goes to just lots of layers of denial, lots of layers right. of self-deception, not just lying to other people or hiding my drinking, but I'm lying to myself, the interference of personal values, kind of breaking through my own ego or pride and being really honest and taking off that mask and being genuine with someone and, you know, confiding in a trusted friend or perhaps just showing up in the emergency department and talking to a random social worker. Right. Sometimes that's easier than confiding in someone that knows me personally.
Heather, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, things that stand in the way of some communities being able to access this possibility to its fullest.
I was actually going to comment on one of the other factors I think we need to bring into the conversation is that idea that an alcohol use disorder or a drug use disorder are, again, chronic relapsing disorders, but they're also brain disorders. And so part of the what happens in the brain as someone becomes addicted to alcohol or drugs is that the brain gets hijacked and that our usual pleasure and reward systems, the way that our brain usually operates, gets totally dismantled by the drugs or the alcohol. And so there's a part of us that, you know, it, to some extent it goes beyond willpower because we have so changed our brains, or the drug and the alcohol have so changed our brains that it takes a while to recover from that and to get back to our usual, you know, abilities of our brain to make decisions and to make rational decisions. So I think that we need to just consider that as a piece of it. I think one thing in terms of folks being able to get treatment in Kansas in between 2009 and 2013, only 6% of the people who had an alcohol use disorder got treatment. 6%.
Yeah, that's very low.
It's shameful. It's shameful. We would never allow or put up with that kind of low treatment rate for other kinds of health conditions that we've been talking about, like asthma or diabetes, things that are just as prevalent as substance use disorders. So there is a huge lack of funding for treatment. Most of the treatment in the United States traditionally has been publicly funded. Up to 75% of treatment has been publicly funded. Recently, there have been a number of health reforms, not just ACA, but before that, a Mental Health and Addiction Parity Act that have started to get insurance companies to make sure that they're providing equal coverage for mental health and substance use disorders. And so those kinds of things are definitely increasing access, but there's still a huge gap.
That 6% number in Kansas, how does that compare with national numbers?
It's about the same. So in some places we're looking at maybe 10%, but still there's just a huge gap in terms of the folks who need treatment and the folks who are able to access treatment.
When you look at community to community differences that are as pronounced as the Wyandotte County, Johnson County distinctions, both in terms of rates of reported heavy drinking, where that's higher in Johnson County, and then rates of recovery and successive recovery, which is, actually also higher in Johnson County. When you see those things, it's fascinating to me that so much of our conversation has been on how much of the experience of heavy drinking and alcohol use disorder are highly personal and really transcend differences. So where does the distinction come in? How do you explain big trends like that?
I think that's where, in terms of treatment, we can go back and look at those things like access to care. And I know in your previous segments you've talked about, for example, the difference in primary care physician or primary care provider availability in Johnson and Wyandotte County. And I think that those kinds of disparities in access to health care, which transcend to behavioral health care as well, including substance use disorders, that's where we see some of the cause, or at least some of the barriers. We know that there are multiple paths to recovery, some of which include formal treatment, others of which just include something like AA. And so it's important, I think, that the field and the country as a whole is recognizing those multiple pathways. But many people with a substance use disorder and alcohol use disorder need some kind of specialized treatment services.
Nikki, what is new in treatment and recovery?
That's a great question. I don't know. Maybe Heather might be better able to answer that if she's the evidence-based practice gal over there. We do a lot of, I mean, stuff that's been around for a long time. Of course, we connect people with 12-step meetings. We're doing a lot of mindfulness practice. That's probably newer on the scene of mental health and addiction treatment. I incorporate a lot of CBT practices, cognitive behavioral therapy, specific dialectical behavioral therapy, lots of building skills. How can I cope with emotional distress? How can I cope with cravings? We have psychiatrists on board that help support folks to, you know, regulate anxiety or stabilize mood or even help with anti-craving, specific medications for that. So that's a little bit newer, but I don't know if Heather wants to speak to that further.
Yeah, those are some great examples, I think, Nikki, of folks really trying to push the envelope and bring in more evidence-based practices. What we've seen in the addiction treatment field as a whole across the country in the past 10 to 20 years is that there's been a lot more, there's a lot more research evidence for what works and what doesn't work and what's potentially actually harmful. And there's really been a shift in especially treatment centers getting away from that very confrontational, very kind of negative style of treatment, which is...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think typically treatment, again, in the specialty treatment of, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s was very confrontational, was very more punishing to patients. You know, not just you have to admit that you have a substance use disorder, which to some folks can be extremely helpful, but in this very shame-based way. And we actually had to have research to show that that doesn't work. But what we do now, and I think kind of underlies all the pieces that Nikki was talking about, is something that's motivational, something called motivational interviewing, that really focuses on a person's strengths and pulls their own internal motivation to do something different.
Right. Joy, yeah, what are your thoughts?
Well, and I think it's so important to remember there's, once a person leaves treatment, like everybody loves treatment. The people that I know anyway, we love a vacation, a 30-day vacation of getting away from our lives, our brains, or whatever. But it's when we leave treatment. And I can learn everything I need to know about alcoholism and drug addiction and find my inner child and do all that stuff in treatment, which I did. But then what do you do after you leave treatment? And what happens is so many people just go back to their same place, their same friends, their same lives, their same job, their same liquor store around the corner. And so I think that's why bridging the gap is so important. And I know Shawnee Mission does it. I know other treatment centers that do it. And I think the increase in, we have Oxford houses and halfway houses and a place for this person to transition prior to being stuck back out into the real world is so helpful, because I know at other places where they get their certificate and they take their suitcase and they just go back to their life, and you wonder why they're drinking in 2 weeks, because it's not a 30-day cure. You get a lot of stuff in that 30 days and tools and ideas and things to help you, but then getting to that next step is so important.
We heard about you know, that this is, that people are, the pressure's on kids in Johnson County. And we have a caller who we don't have time to get to, but he has a 15-year-old son who he wants to seek help for. I would think that with what you're describing, the challenges of returning to that same place, children are going to return usually to the same place. And how does treatment for younger people struggling with this differ? And are there specific resources for them in our area?
You know, just working on the DAC, I know that there are a few school districts now that are really incorporating a ton of education and information and even some sober support groups in those private Johnson County schools. So we are kind of normalizing, you know, being sober and leading a healthy life is okay and acceptable. And this is a great path for you to take at this time.
Jump in, Heather.
I was going to say, particularly in Johnson County, there are adolescent treatment services that are available. And in terms of adolescent treatment, what the research shows is that it really needs to be a family approach.
Yes.
So the more traditional approaches to working with an individual apply as well for adolescents, but also to have a family approach that really gets the whole family involved in a person's recovery. Mm-hmm.
Anything being talked about your field in terms of overcoming challenges to recovery that you think we should be looking toward on the horizon?
I think, as Joy mentioned, that idea, again, this is a chronic relapsing disorder, and we shouldn't think that someone can go to a treatment, an inpatient treatment, or, you know, 30 days of treatment, they're not going to be cured. Right. It's a long-term recovery kind of process, and we need to be supporting people across their lifespan.
Well, thanks so much for this conversation today. We've got to go now, but it's been great having you all here. Heather J. Gotham is an associate research professor in the School of Nursing and Health Studies at UMKC. Thanks so much, Heather.
You're welcome.
And Nikki Green with us from Shawnee Mission Health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joy, we really, really appreciate you sharing your story today.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
To listen back to this show or anything you've heard on Central Standard, head to kcur.org/Central Standard later today. KCPT's Kansas City Week in Review this Friday evening will feature a video created as part of the Crossing to Health series. It looks at a free fitness program designed to combat inactivity in the Argentine neighborhood of Kansas City, Kansas. Tomorrow, join us for a portrait session. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Alex Smith and the Heartland Health Monitor. I'm Gina Kaufman.